Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
A full bird colonel in the United States Air Force, an immigrant, a lawyer, and a member of the United States Congress. But most importantly, a dad to two talented boys and a husband to an equally talented and dedicated public servant. Ted Lieu epitomizes what it means to serve with pride. Today's show is a very special one in myriad ways as we speak with a lifelong friend of mine and a lifelong advocate for what's right, Congressman Ted Lieu. Ted truly has personified the definition of public servant. He has always led with integrity and grace and courage. And it's a great honor to have Ted with us today to discuss where we are and where we are going.
It is such a great honor to have Congressman Lieu on our show, and I've been eagerly awaiting this conversation. I mean, putting your life on the line for your country is indeed a great form of service. But as I follow Congressman Lieu's words and actions, I see a man who truly loves his country and her people. He consistently speaks up for those who are vulnerable, those who are young, for our climate, and for Americans of different ethnic backgrounds. Congressman Lieu is a voice for all of us, and I can't wait to chat with him right now on Bold Ideas.
Thank you again, Congressman Lieu. It's quite an honor to have you with us today. The conversations that we have had on this podcast, on the show thus far, have been quite profound and often very specific as to what exactly we can do together as a state, as a country, to rebuild and to refocus after such a tumultuous year, which obviously is still progressing. One of our recent guests who lives here in Vermont, just an extraordinary, prolific author, the remarkable Bill Schubart, he and I spoke about leadership just a couple shows ago, and he spoke so eloquently about leadership specifically, Ted, the difference in leadership versus crisis management. And I do think that there is a significant difference, and of course it relates to where we are now. We have all been managing crisis for what seems like years. Public crisis, private crisis, pandemic crises, and now we need leadership. And you have shown, Ted, throughout your entire career, leadership. You have shown what it means to be a leader in the United States Congress and a leader globally for what is right and what matters. So Congressman, whence does that leadership come, from your opinion? How do we encourage the best and the brightest to aspire to positions of government leadership? How do we encourage people and talk about, really, the extraordinary power of policy and politics and government to make things right, just like you've always discussed?
Well, thank you, David, for first of all, inviting me on the show. I'm honored to be on with you and Meg. And let me first say that anyone can be a leader. It doesn't necessarily have to be in government. You can be a leader in the private sector, in nonprofits, and so on. Now, if you're interested in government, and if you're interested in working on policies that could, you know, affect an entire nation or on your city council or in a state, then I think you should think about, first of all, why you want to do it. And if you can have a good reason to tell yourself and your family why you want to do it, then you should pursue it. And in terms of leadership, I think it matters that you're doing what you believe is right based on what you think the facts are and not what other people may think or may not think. And I think at the end of the day, many elected officials realize they cannot please everyone all the time. So we don't. We simply try to do what we think is in the best interests of the majority of the people.
And Congressman, that actually echoes so much of what we've talked about, and certainly what what Bill talked about in his conversation about leadership, that the job of a leader is not to make, as you said, not to make everyone happy, but to look, to in some ways look to the future and make those decisions that matter and are in the best interest of the whole. And I think that is absolutely correct. It's a, too often leadership has been seen, again, whether it's in government or in business or in any other capacity, as a popularity contest. And that is certainly not what defines true leadership and not what will allow us now to rebuild in a way that takes us and our children to the future.
That's absolutely correct. And probably for elected officials, I remember thinking when I got first elected to the California State Legislature that I loved what I was doing, but also I was hundreds of miles away from my family half the days during a week. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to be doing this, I better be doing something that is right and be doing something that's important. Otherwise, I should just quit and go back and be with my family and make a lot more money in the private sector. So that was a very freeing thought. And now when I look at issues and decisions, my view is, you know, if my constituents don't like what I did, they can certainly fire me and then I'll go to the private sector and make a bunch more money. But I think that is what lets a lot more people do the right thing and become leaders if they understand that they're not wedded to being in that particular position.
Yeah, you touched on something there that I wanted to ask you about, Congressman Liu, because we come from a small state, as you know, although some of our leaders are 100 miles away from their home. But we've also seen really in the movements of the last year or two, particularly around different kinds of racial justice movements, that there are a lot of systemic barriers that make it quite difficult for amazing leaders, amazing community leaders, to rise to higher levels. There's just a lot of barriers in place. And I was wondering if you could just think a little bit about the current systems that we have and what kinds of changes, either in infrastructure or approach, you think that a small state like Vermont could make to try and remove some of those barriers to participation and really build a truly diversified leadership here.
Thank you, Meg, for that question. Let me first say, you all do have an amazing leader in Congressman Peter Welch.
We do.
I've served with him in Congress. He is fantastic. So just want to put a plug out for Peter. I think Abraham Lincoln had it right when he said that public sentiment is everything. With it, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed. And I want everyone listening to understand their power to help shape public sentiment. If you look at, for example, how the Women's March started, it literally was a Facebook post by a person who just sort of put the idea out. If you look at the marches that happened after the murder of George Floyd, it was a group of people from Black Lives Matter, but we're not talking about tens of thousands who were in that organization. It was a relatively small handful that started the initial seed for all these marches that occurred across America. And so I want individuals to understand that they have immense power themselves to shape public sentiment. Social media is free. So if you write a interesting post, maybe you'll affect someone in Ohio or in Florida or in California. Think about writing letters to the editor. It's true that many people do write letters to the editor. It's also true that many of them come from the same people. So when you start writing in, then eventually you'll get published and you can start changing hearts and minds.
I love that.
It's a really interesting thing that Meg and I have discussed many times related to the point you just made of personal efficacy. So much of the conversation that we have in our communities is, well, when you see all of these issues and problems in our world, what do you do about it? Well, in many ways, the answer is you have to start doing something about it and using your voice, using the things that we at least can control, which is our own analysis and voice of situations, and begin to make a difference. I think it's exactly right.
The other thing I want to point out is that as a legislator, both in the California State Legislature as well as in Congress, on any given legislative cycle, basically it's usually 2 years, I vote well over 1,000 times. And I'd say in 80 to 90% of those votes, I do not get a single phone call, email, fax, or meeting. So when you start calling in and demanding meetings or expressing your opinions to state or federal legislatures, it can make a very real difference, because then the members of Congress or state legislatures or their staff start wondering, well, why is someone asking about this issue? What's so important about this issue that's causing folks to write in or call in? Same thing in city council. Many of them make decisions with no public input because no one shows up to express their opinions. Think about showing up, express your opinion. And if you're the only one there expressing an opinion, well, guess what? It's going to have an outsized influence. So think about all you can do to just get involved in civics and in government, because most people don't. And if you get involved, you can make a difference.
Congressman, that's a remarkable segue to a question that I think is really at the heart of this conversation. So many people are not involved because they feel that it is just simply what is occurring in our civic sphere is so distasteful. And we hear that all the time. You hear that, I hear that. People will say, look, it's just a fight. It's just a fight. It's not anything but a fight. I obviously disagree with that premise. I mean, there's a quote I'll read to you in a minute, but really this conversation, the partisan divide, which I actually believe, Congressman, is more of a sectarian divide that is now so much in evidence in our society, is so clearly obvious now, but is so deeply rooted in our history. So from vaccines to school curriculums, we are a people that is deeply divided. This is not new, but it is so clearly in evidence now, and it really relates to what you just talked about. People need to get involved, but before they get involved, and in order to get involved, they have to believe that what they have to say matters.
So I can talk to you about Congress. I remember before I got to Congress, I thought, they fight a lot. Now that I'm in Congress, it's true, we fight a lot. It's also true, a lot of things are happening on bipartisan, bicameral basis that you don't read about. For some reason, you don't read about planes that land. Doesn't sell newspapers, doesn't get TV advertising, it's not interesting. So media, most of them are for profit, they require conflict, right, to get you to watch their stories and to sell advertising. So what actually ends up happening in Congress is there's always bills being passed that are helping the American people. I'll give you an example. Last term, I wrote a bill along with senators and members of Congress. It was bipartisan, it was bicameral, that improved cybersecurity at the Department of Homeland Security. It passed the House, passed the Senate, was signed by the former president, and you don't know about it because no one covered it because it was not going to sell newspaper advertising. So that continues to happen. Now on big issues like healthcare or taxes and so on, yes, there's going to be fights, but there is a lot of bipartisan cooperation support. I write a number of letters with members of the Republican Party to various agencies, asking them questions or asking them to make fixes or correct things. We just saw that the U.S. Senate passed on a bipartisan basis a major infrastructure package. So you can still have a lot of bipartisan things get done. It's just not the way the media portrays it, because they have an incentive to simply portray conflict.
That is so much at the heart of what I think in some ways is broken about our current system of conversation, our current system of dialogue, or to that extent, even our civic discourse. It is, when I say we, thriving on chaos. And I would, if I looked back, I actually think reality TV did a lot to really help people think about, well, you know, I want conflict. I want to look at conflict. And so our civic commons became a theater for conflict as opposed to a civic commons for dialogue and discourse. I love what you articulated, that's right, the press doesn't talk about planes that land. I remember a long time ago, I have an entrepreneurial idea. Start a newspaper with all good things every day, the good news about people's life. And then I realized, well, it would probably fail. And I remember being quite depressed about that, but realizing your exact point, that conflict and chaos, not only does it sell, but I think to the conversation we've just had, it has too much so defined the public square.
That's correct. And something else that happened last few decades is the fragmentation of media. So when we were growing up, right, we would watch Tom Brokaw and Peter Jennings. There were, you know, three major news networks and pretty much everything was self-moderated. Now, if you tend to be liberal, you'll tend to watch MSNBC. If you're conservative, you'll watch Fox. And if you're really, really to the right, you might watch, you know, OAN or Newsmax. And if you watch those channels, the facts that they tell you are completely different from each other. And it's really hard to look at the two realities being presented because oftentimes they're completely different realities. And I think that also is causing some of the conflict that we see in America today.
So there's a quote that I want to read. And then what you just said, I want to get to what we do about this. What do we do about this to try to bring us together? This is from a book that I've just finished reading by H.L. Mencken, written in 1922, called A Book of Prefaces. Mencken was a critic, a political critic, a literary critic, just generally a critic, not the most positive of human beings, but his words are profound, and this fascinated me. Andrew Jackson was the progenitor of the New Statesman. He carried the mob's distrust of good taste even into the field of civic conduct and civic discourse. He was the first to put the rewards of conformity above the dictates of common decency. There has not been a presidential contest since Jackson's day without its use of the phrase of Armageddon's. The most successful American politicians have been those most adept at twisting the ancient tropes of intolerance to partisan uses. Well, I read that and I dog-eared it, and then I underlined it, and then I took a picture of it, and then I wrote it down because I thought, well, that could as well have been written today. And it relates so much to what you just talked about relative to chaos and crisis and Armageddon. So how do we get past this, Congressman? How do we, and it's such a complex topic, of course, but I know you've thought about it very deeply. You practice it in your daily life, certainly in the U.S. House, but also in the work you do at home in California and in your own life. How do we begin to bridge these divides and work toward that common space and the commons being a place of dialogue and constructive behavior?
That's a great question. And you're absolutely right that throughout United States history, we've had conflict. We had an entire civil war. We had over 120,000 Japanese Americans that were forcibly interned in World War II, right? We had the entire civil rights movement and so on. So conflict is not something that's unusual in US history. I think what's a little different in last few years that I've noticed than, for example, from two decades ago is there was always misinformation out there, but the internet has caused it to spread to much more people in a way that didn't happen before. And I don't know, for example, why someone would trust a Facebook post instead of their own doctor telling them about vaccines, for example, or why someone would trust something they see on Twitter versus a medical expert talking about why masks work. But people do that. And so now you do have all this disinformation out there that I think does make it harder to solve problems, because in the past, we agree on the same set of facts, and then you get differing opinions on it. But if someone's gonna tell you that what is clearly a banana is an apple, then you've got some major problems. It's very hard to fix that. I'm not exactly sure how to fix that.
I think one of the reasons, I love that, first of all, where you talk about, like, you can have the same facts and differing opinions. That is what I remember. And what concerns me now is I think people are longing for community in a really deep way that maybe we weren't before. And so they're taking sort of beliefs as a way to feel part of a community. And as somebody who's looking at it from the ground level, what we're seeing is sparks of violence in a way that we hadn't seen before from, at least that I can remember. When people had disagreements, you might have protests, you might have wild signs or whatever, but you didn't have, you know, people really hurting other people, burning their vehicles, burning their houses, painting racist slogans in front of their houses. And you know, that really worries me, and I see you dealing with it, Congressman Liu. I'm one of your many online stalkers who really appreciate some of the quotes and tweets that you put out that really draw the line and are just like, we can disagree on facts. We can't do this. This is past the line. And I'd love to like think about like how can we help people figure out how to disagree in a space that isn't right or wrong, because life isn't right or wrong. Life is the gray areas in between, right?
That's correct. It's interesting you point out the violence aspect of it. We saw that happen on January 6th because it wasn't just a disagreement. It turned violent, and people were trying to violently stop the certification of Electoral College results for Joe Biden. You also see it, for example, in the rise of hate crimes against Asian Americans. Last year, overall hate crimes went down, but hate crimes against Asian Americans spiked to approximately 150% in major cities across America. And part of that did have to do with the pandemic, where you had a former president using racist phrases like Kung Flu and so on that would cause people to think that Asian Americans were somehow carrying the virus or promoting it. But I also wonder if it has to do with people who are fearful of change. We do know that according to the US census results that recently came out, Asian Americans are the fastest increasing ethnic group in America. The population has doubled in size since 2000. And by 2055, Asian Americans are projected to be the largest immigrant group in America. And so throughout our history, you also see that when there is change, you also do see sort of some violent resistance to that change.
We've seen so much, I think that's absolutely correct. We've seen so much proof of that change is not only frightening, but that results and manifests in so much negative, both interaction and negative conversation. And I think that part of this altogether, including even the architecture of change, relates to what you said just a few moments ago. You can't have a conversation about an apple if one person says it's an apple and the other says it's a banana, or the sky is orange or blue or green, if the very basic facts of existence are up for debate, if you will. If truth is debatable, we are obviously seeing the results of individual truths, relative truths, as opposed to actual existing facts that can then be debated and certainly about which people can have different opinions. My own opinion about this is that we are seeing the result of decades of the degradation of an academic process, resulting in people not being taught, but B, not understanding truly what the power of critical thought. We're not necessarily teaching our children within schools and generally a society critical thought, because critical thought at the end of the day is what allows someone to say, well, I heard this on this news or on this network. I heard this on this network. I saw this on Facebook. I saw this on Twitter. I'm now going to put it all together and come up with a set of conclusions that requires critical thought. And that isn't about innately being able to be critical. It's just simply, those are taught, learned skills. And I fear we have ceased to teach them in the way that we must to avoid this absolute, not only degradation of, but difference in analysis of what truly facts are all about.
That's a great point. And I think part of it also has to do with sort of going back to media again, what media does, right? They tend to put out the most extreme statements because it's interesting, right? And so what you have, for example, when you look at members of Congress is the member of Congress was talking about, let's spend some money and build a bridge. That person doesn't get covered, but the person goes out there and says, you know, some inflammatory extreme statement, they'll get covered. And I think there's also a disconnect between what do people actually believe and what you actually see in the media. So if you look at polling, for example, it turns out that overwhelming majorities of people support vaccination and support masks. You might not know that if you just watch the media, because you're seeing all these anti-mask protests and people who are anti-vaxxers and so on. So there's also a difference between what we watch and see versus what do most people in their homes actually believe.
Well, Congressman, we could obviously have this conversation for the next couple hours. And we've Meg and I have talked about this, that there is a temporal problem with podcasts, and that these just conversations make us want to continue for an entire day. But that's probably not, that's certainly not what you, Congressman Liu, need to be doing with your time, although we would, and I would love it. So I want to say thank you. Thank you personally. Thank you on behalf of the nation for what you do every single day. I know here in Vermont, so many of our colleagues and friends and neighbors know of you and respect you. And as Meg said, follow your words and your actions, because they're so worthy of the following that you've created. And we're deeply grateful for the time today, but what you do every day.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on your show. And for anyone who is listening, if you do have questions about the vaccine, please talk to your doctor. That is a very good source of information. If you don't have a doctor, look at what medical organizations have said about the vaccines.
Perfect. No better way to end this. Thank you. Thank you very much, Congressman.
Thank you.
What an important conversation with a leader whom history will remember quite kindly. In fact, I've known Ted for decades. And I was really struck in this conversation, Meg, that a conversation he and I had, again, decades ago, as we were actually hiking in the hills above Los Angeles, the district, the area that he now represents, he and I were much younger. And what he said about wanting to serve and hoping to change things for the better, those are the same things, literally the exact same words he said decades ago as he said today as we talked. And that consistency of leadership, I think, is not only so important, but it's what all of us should aspire to. I actually think the most important takeaways from the conversation today with Congressman Liu relate to how we all must work to reclaim the commons, to reclaim the civic space that we all occupy, reclaim it from those forces of chaos and forces of division and misinformation and flat out lies and deceit that are running rampant. And when that happens, we once again will be able to encourage and teach and practice critical thought. And then that will help lead us to a place where, once again, public service, public leadership, the kind that Congressman Liu typifies, that needs once again to be respected, admired, and pursued as it should be.
Absolutely. And, you know, what I really loved, because, you know, I'm a grassroots person and I believe that it is up to all of us to change the world, was a couple times when I asked him about, like, well, what do we have to do for leaders? And he said, everyone can do it. They just have to do something. And I really, really loved about how he so eloquently reminded us that we all have something so great to offer, whether it's in our local town, in our state, or nationally in the House of Representatives, as he's doing, and that the first step is just to do something. So I was so grateful to share that space with both of you and listen to his voice and to feel his commitment and dedication to public service. It was quite a conversation.
Something also Congressman Liu knows, as we've talked about it, my dad always said to me, don't talk about it, do it. In our cases, and certainly we need to do both of the things. We need to talk about it, then we need to go do it. That's what this is about. And thanks to everyone. Thanks for everyone for listening to today's show. As you know, like always, if you have questions or thoughts or comments, we want to hear from you. Send us an email to ideas@boldideaspod.com. Submit questions, thoughts, again, anything. And we very much look forward to speaking with you and being with you again in just a couple weeks. Remember to think bold.
That's right. And if you're an Apple user, you could give us a rating and that would really help us out. And you could also share a comment so that we know what you're thinking and can integrate it into our show. So right now, please subscribe to the show wherever you're listening so you don't miss another episode of Bold Ideas from Vermont, and don't miss our next episode and opportunity to think boldly with us. Thanks so much.